Welcome back to the MLB.com StatCast podcast. I'm your host, Mike Petriello, joined here by Matt Myers, MLB.com national editor. And it's almost an emergency podcast. It's Monday before the World Series starts tomorrow, and we felt like we don't usually record on Mondays, but we have to get a podcast down before the series starts, right?
Yes, we want to get our predictions, our hot takes on record. For the record, if we're talking about predictions, my World Series prediction was Dodgers over Astros back in April, so I'm feeling pretty good right now.
I think I said Cubs over Astros, but we both, I'm sure, had Dodgers Cubs in the NLCS. I mean, this is the series that 2017 was always promised, right? Like, I guess with Cleveland at the end of the year, you can't really say these are by far the two best teams, but these were the teams that this season, I think, should have ended up with. Like, all due respect to the Yankees, they're going to be here for a long time. 2017 should be Dodgers Astros. I'm so pleased at the outcome here.
Yes, and as you've probably seen, it's the first World Series since 1970. Where both teams had 100 wins. So that's pretty cool. Like, that's been a long time that, like, basically the two best regular season teams have kind of met in the playoffs.
This is a tangent, I guess.
In the World Series.
Now I need to go back and figure out how many seasons since then have even had 200 win teams in opposite leagues. I don't know the answer to that. I bet you it's not every single season. Anyway, there's a lot to talk about. And I guess at the end, we will make some predictions. And then I'm going to fly off to LA tomorrow to see the first two games in person. And I'm very excited about that. And we're going to get into just how hot it's going to be in Los Angeles in a minute. But first, let's talk about how we got here. And I think, you know, we've talked a lot about these teams in the regular season so far. And I'm sort of interested in what they've done in the postseason. And I guess we can just put out one overarching, everything is a small sample size caveat for everything else we talk about, because we're not talking about a ton of October games here, right?
Of course, but I mean, we're going to get into expected outcomes, expected weighted on base, expected batting average, expected slugging. And part of what those tools are supposed to do is sort of like cut through some of the small sample size issues. Again, it's still apparent, but it cuts through it a little bit.
Right. So these two teams were very, very good in the regular season, and obviously they made it to the World Series, so they've been very, very good in the postseason. So for the most part, there's not a tremendous amount of difference except for one particular area. So I look at what they've done so far hitting, right? So the Dodgers so far in the postseason, expected weighted on base has been 345. Now remember, that's quality of contact. It does include strikeouts and walks. The league average this year was 327. So 345, that's above average. Their actual has been 374. As you'd expect, a team playing this well has, you know, gotten a little bit, I don't want to say lucky, but let's say fortunate. Like, they've outperformed a little bit. And then it's interesting for the Astros. Their expected weighted on base is 332, not terribly different from 345. Their actual is 322. And I think we talked about this last week with all those barrels against the Yankees that they absolutely did not get.
Yeah, I have to say, I feel a little bit of vindication for people who listened to our last episode after Game 5. We recorded Yankees had just taken the 3-2 lead, winning three straight at home. And we kind of went through the Astros' results versus performance in the games leading up to that in the ALCS, and basically said they've been hitting the ball a lot harder than, you know, the results would indicate. So look for that to turn around in Houston. Sure enough, they scored 7 runs in Game 6, 4-0 win in Game 7. It worked out pretty nicely.
And if you believe in karma, one of those runs was a Jose Altuve 1% home run. That ball is literally a home run 1% of the time. I mean, we expected a little bit of that with those ballparks.
And that's also part of the formula here, is like, you know, when things quote unquote kind of even out, you know, you start to get some of those, you know, going your way that sort of balances out some of the, like, you know, 400-foot barrels that end up in Aaron Hicks's glove.
So, yeah, I think overall the hitting skill level has been similar, right? I know the Astros have, you know, they had an amazing ALDS against the Red Sox, and then it was pretty rough against the Yankees for a while. But when we look at the actual hitters, so there are 70 hitters so far this postseason with at least 10 plate appearances, and as you'd expect, these two teams are really, like, littering the top here, but it's so much more Dodgers. If I'm looking at the top 10 here and I'm looking at expected weighted on base, number one in baseball so far this postseason at 506, Enrique Hernandez. Now, he did hit 3 home runs in one game, and let's point out what a boost that was, because in all the other games of this postseason, he's only had 10 plate appearances, 250 batting average, 400 on base, 375 slugging. It's fine. But, like, he's made his entire October, maybe his entire career, because of that one single game. Yeah. And I think it's also funny, just as a side note, now I've heard from a lot of Dodger fans who are like, you have to start him every single game. He's got power potential. And I'm like, listen, I know he hit one of those home runs against the righty when Hector Rondon just, like, laid the fattest slider you've ever seen. But he mashes lefties for his career. 270 on base, 270 batting average against lefties, 364 on base, 518 slugging. That's 37 points above league average against lefty pitching. That's great. Start him against Dallas Keuchel. Against righties, 207 265, 324, 37 points below average against righties. He should not be playing against any right-handed pitcher. So, yes, against Keuchel, no against everybody else.
A quick aside about Kike Hernandez. I just discovered, I'd forgotten, I should say, that he actually debuted with, he came up with the Astros and debuted with the Astros in 2014. He played 24 games with the Astros and hit his first career home run with them. The only home run he hit with them. So, but it's a great moment. I went back and watched it. I encourage you to do the same. His whole family's in the stands, and the Astros broadcast had a camera on his family when he hit the home run. I guess those were the lean years for the Astros, so they were, I think, looking for anything to get excited about. So they had a camera following Kike Hernandez's family for his MLB debut, and his family's going nuts as the ball goes over the fence. It's pretty cool. Of course, he hit it off Chris Young, a former StatCast podcast favorite and a right-handed pitcher. But the numbers are pretty clear. He should and will start against Keuchel. I do not think he will start against anyone else.
Nor absolutely should he. I'm just looking at the other top hitters this postseason. Four of the top five are in this World Series. You know, Hernandez is number one. Altuve is number three. That makes sense. Justin Turner is tied with him. Seager didn't actually play in the NLCS, but he was very good against the Diamondbacks, so he's in the top five. I think we're always going to forget how good Michael Taylor actually was in that Washington series, a 496 expected weighted on base. Also in this our top dozen here, Gurriel, Chris Taylor, Puig, Forsyth. Good teams are good is the takeaway.
Gurriel actually has the highest exit velocity of any batter in the postseason and the most hard hit balls.
That's actually very interesting because I remember he was almost seen as a bit of the weak link coming into the season. What we're going to get from him? He had a really nice year. Now, this is interesting, and file this away for a little later. Of all these 70 batters, the weakest expected weighted on base, Curtis Granderson, a .086. So the team with the best offense has had the single worst hitter. I know I pumped this guy up a lot. I'm kind of crushed by this.
But also, to go back a second, isn't he often the guy that kind of would get in instead of Kike Hernandez?
Well, as like platoon partners.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So, I mean, despite this, it's sort of an interesting yin and yang here, right? Because part of the reason I'm guessing why Dodgers fans are calling for Kike to play every game is because of how bad Granderson looked. Am I wrong?
Well, there's no question about that. Granderson's looked awful, but they do have Ethier as an option. Peterson's an option. They have a lot of lefty guys who don't have to be Granderson. I'm not even sure if 100% sure Granderson makes the roster. Like, we're assuming from our vantage point here on Monday afternoon, Seager will make it on. We don't know who's going to be dropped for him.
And yeah, that's true, because also I think that Dave Roberts said that if Seager makes it, they're going to keep Culberson too as insurance. So that's right. It could be Granderson is the odd man out.
I would say I would not keep Culberson, because I feel like you could take Seager, and if he has to leave a game, you can put Chris Taylor back as shortstop. You can even put Hernandez there. And if there's something seriously enough wrong with Seager that he has to be removed, you just bring Culberson back. That's what I would do. I don't think that's what's going to happen. Anyway, going to the pitching side now, I think this is interesting too. The Dodgers pitching has been really good, but it sort of breaks down into starters and relievers. Overall, the Dodgers pitchers have been better. 257 expected weighted on base. Now Houston's got a 297. And the Dodgers have had a 242 actual weighted on base, and Houston has had a 301. So basically, on both sides, earning more or less what they've received. Now, it gets a little different when you split it into rotation and bullpen. The Houston rotation has been fantastic. Obviously, Verlander has been a monster, but Keuchel's been great. And we saw Charlie Morton. I've been a huge fan of Charlie Morton for so many years. We said the last week he looked great, I think, in that Game 3 and gave up 7 runs, but visually he looked great. And then Game 7, he looked great, and he actually was great. And I had so many people like tweeting at me going, wait a minute, Charlie Morton throws 97 with movement on the outside corner? And it's like, yeah. And his answer for that was, I tried to. I decided I was going to do this, and it worked.
On Saturday night during the game, literally within a span of like 4 minutes, I got text messages from two different friends who obviously haven't been paying that close attention, being like, wait, Charlie Morton throws 97 now?
movement and a high spin rate, and he's fantastic. So anyway, because of the, you know, Verlander and all these guys, Houston's starting rotation so far, 282 expected on base, which is great, and a 280 actual. So exactly what you'd expect. Dodgers have been very good as well. 302 expected, 295 actual. So both of these teams have a pair of elite aces at the top of the rotation, right? Kershaw and
no question.
Darvish, and then Verlander and Keuchel, and then some very interesting names following them up. Now we go to the bullpen. This is where things are going to get a little bit different. We've talked about the Dodgers bullpen, and they were unbelievable. 182 expected weighted on base, a 154 actual weighted on base, which seems almost impossible. And then the Astros, 320 expected, and a 338 actual. Now, to be fair, Lance McCullers was fantastic in Game 7 in relief. He looked great. But, you know, they've got a lot of good names down there, like Gregerson and Giles and Devenski. And the performance hasn't been there at all.
Yeah, and the manager A.J. Hinch is in a weird spot because he clearly has lost faith in basically all those guys. And maybe the couple days of, you know, between series to get a little bit of a reset, give a little pep talk. I don't know what he's going to do, but it was abundantly clear by the end of the series that he had no faith in them, even bringing in Ken Giles with a 7-1 lead in game six, which seemed crazy because you thought, like, you're going to want him for two innings possibly in game seven. They sort of lucked out and ended up not having to use anyone other than McCullers. But, I mean, right now, and this, to me, this is, like, the biggest storyline of the World Series is who's he going to trust in his bullpen? Who can actually come through and get some big outs? Because, you know, a lot of what we've seen now with the modern game is it used to be as recently as maybe a couple years ago with a lot of teams, it was like a strategy had become, okay, let's take a lot of pitches. Let's try and wear out the starting pitcher and get to the bullpen. Get to, like, the, you know, the middle of the bullpen. With a lot of teams now, that's a bad strategy. You actually hope you get to bat against the starter the third time instead of facing their bullpen coming in the fifth inning, particularly a bullpen like the Dodgers, for example.
Yeah, and not only has he not had faith in his relievers, AJ Hinch really didn't make many moves, right? Like, they haven't used their bench at all. Juan Centeno is the third catcher. He's had one plate appearance. Derek Fisher hasn't hit in, like, 10 days. I think Cameron Maypin got, like, that one start. And so I wonder, you know, will they make any moves on their roster? StatCast's favorite Jake Marisnyk may actually potentially be available. I know he hurt his thumb.
I think that if he's on the roster, he's only going to be in basically in a defensive replacement pinch running role. I mean, granted, they didn't use Fisher any more than that anyway, so it's not like they'd really be losing much. But anyway, so the point I was trying to make, though, is that, like, with a team like the Astros right now, you want your starting pitchers to give you as much length as possible. But the Dodgers, obviously a very patient team, can wait you out. And I feel like a big subplot is going to be them taking pitches, trying to wear up kind of this more like trend of 5 years ago, like trying to get to that Astros bullpen as early as possible.
Which is hilarious to think about saying that like 4 months ago. It's like, man, I can't wait to face Chris Devensky. Yeah. Like everything is out of tech.
But that's what it is right now. And it'll also be really interesting in the first two games in the NL Park. When do you pinch hit for your pitcher? Because you're not, I mean, you don't get much from pitchers anyway, but you're definitely not getting anything from Verlander or Keuchel at the plate. So there's going to be a situation probably in like the fifth inning where there's two men on with two outs. And it's like, what do you do?
Yeah.
Where the book would certainly say pinch hit, but with the way this team is set up now, there's no way Hinch does it.
I mean, that's one of the many things I really enjoy about this matchup, because there's so many interesting questions like that. And kind of going back to these pitchers here, 62 pitchers so far this postseason have faced 10 guys. You know, Kenley Jansen is only number two in expected weighted on base. It's actually Kenta Maeda who's been the best. Now, granted, 15 plate appearances, we're not exactly talking about a lot, but he has become a really, really strong weapon with that cutter against right-handed batters. And I can easily see, you know, Kershaw going 6 1/3 or whatever, and then here comes like George Springer, and it's going to be Kenta Maeda. I mean, I think that's perfect. That's a really good use of him. And also on this the top list here, like Tony Watson's up there, Brandon Morrow, Yu Darvish. There's actually 5 Dodgers before you get to the first Astro, which is Verlander. And then, as I said, remember before that Curtis Granderson has been the least effective batter. Well, the least effective pitcher of any pitcher is Will Harris. I kind of like that these two great teams each have like one guy pulling up the rear.
Yeah, it's Will Harris, and that's the Astros roster situation, sort of the back of that bullpen could also end up being, you know, a pretty interesting discussion because of the Marisnyk question, him hanging over, and if they're going to want to try and be more aggressive with platoons against the left-handed pitchers that the Dodgers have. Because, you know, if you insist on playing McCann and you insist on playing Josh Reddick, which it sort of seems like Hinch is going to do because he played them both against CC Sabathia in Game 7, particularly if he started Reddick in Game 7 against Sabathia when Reddick was 0-22 or whatever, I can't imagine he's going to sit him now.
And he's not going to start Gattis. Gattis did not catch Dallas Keuchel one time all season long. It's very difficult to imagine that will change a game more of the world.
But that really hinders your lineup if you're the Astros, because it basically against the tough lefty, Kershaw for sure, and even Rich Hill, you're really kind of behind the eight ball if you're basically essentially punting those two slots in the lineup, not to mention the pitcher having to hit.
And don't forget, Alex Wood is going to get a start too. The Dodgers have three lefties in the starting rotation around Yu Darvish.
I mean, on the flip side, at the top of the order, most of the Astros' best hitters are right-handed hitters. So they're sort of well-equipped at the top of the order to hit those guys. But the bottom of the order, it's a little more dicey. Granted, for his career, for 2017 at least, Josh Reddick did not have much of a split in terms of batting average and OPP, but he hit for much more power against righties.
Yes, and you know, we always, single year splits are always concerning. Like Yasiel Puig actually had a weird reverse split this year, which he never did before.
But I mean, Reddick, I only looked at those splits just because he's sort of been a weird hitter who's actually kind of transformed himself a bit over his career. He used to be actually kind of a high strikeout guy.
Oh, yeah.
And now he's like a guy who hardly ever, like by the standards of the modern game, he basically never strikes out.
Yeah, he's just like the rest of the Astros, right? We talked about that. So what I find interesting is, you know, I think the narrative of the Astros so far has been Justin Verlander, right? Has been unbelievable, but he's not starting in game one. It's Dallas Keuchel and it's Kershaw. And that's a really, really great matchup. I mean, I guess you throw Chris Sale in there, and that's probably two of the three best left-handed starters in baseball. So that's exactly what you want. Like, this has always been the issue for the Dodgers in the past. Kershaw has to save their bacon at the end, and now they're starting, you know, Dan Haran or whoever is like their fourth starter because he's rested. So I think this is interesting because, as we're going to get into in a second, it's going to be really hot. The ball is going to fly a little bit. These two pitchers, Keuchel especially, do a great job of keeping the ball low in the zone. I mean, Keuchel had a ground ball rate of 67%. That's the best of any starting pitcher with 100 innings this year. And if you look on Baseball Savant, we have our detailed zone, so you can look at the lower third of the zone and actually the edges right below it. Nobody in baseball, no starting pitcher who threw at least 250 pitches, threw more pitches in that area than Dallas Keuchel at nearly 30%. But Clayton Kershaw's up there too. He's actually sixth, and Alex Wood right behind him, so 27%. So I found that interesting. You have these two guys who do a really good job at throwing the ball low in the zone. But then I thought to myself, well, these are two pretty good offenses, and these are two offenses that crush lefties. So I looked up the opposite. What were the best offenses against lefties who threw low in the zone, and both in the top six, Dodgers and Astros? And then I thought, well, what about
top six in terms of expected weighted on base?
Excuse me, expected weighted on base. And then I thought, well, what about just against lefties overall? And if you look at expected weighted on base, the Dodgers had the third best mark against lefties, and the Astros had the fourth best. And then in actual outcomes, and this is, I think, where Minute Maid Park comes in a little bit, Astros were second, and the Dodgers are fourth. So this is really interesting because you have two undeniably elite starting pitchers against two offenses that do a pretty good job of mashing lefties, which is especially ironic because that was a story last year that the Dodgers couldn't hit lefties, and now they're great against lefties. But I think that's a really interesting strength versus strength matchup that we're going to see in game one.
Yeah, but I mean, and it will be, I'm, you know, sort of fascinating to see how Hinch sets his lineup, and if he does end up playing Maben to really try and strengthen the balance against Kershaw. I still don't think he will, but it'll be a little gutsy for him to do it, particularly after he sort of fell out of favor after that misplay in game three.
I don't think he will either, but yeah, you're right. And I think obviously for the Dodgers, that's the one game where you will see Kike Hernandez playing left field. I think the other big story, as I look forward to finding out in person tomorrow, it's going to be so hot in LA. The average temperature in LA at this time of year is 77 degrees. It is expected to be 100 degrees for game one and then 97 degrees the next day for game two. And we did a little work in looking into the hottest World Series games ever. Now, obviously, we don't have reliable temperature data going back to 1908 and all this stuff. But for what we do have, the hottest tracked temperature was 94 degrees for the first game of the 2001 World Series Yankees at Arizona. The roof was open. We looked this up. And this is going to be considerably warmer than that. So there's a lot of factors that are going to come into play here, not to mention the sweat of like 40,000 people. It's going to be disgusting there. But no, obviously there's some physics that goes into working. Like, you're going to hear on the broadcast, this ball is flying out of here tonight, right? You're just going to hear it a lot. And sometimes those things don't really make sense, but I think in this case, it's actually going to be valid. So I did a little bit of research. We looked up the work of esteemed physicist and former StatCast podcast guest, Dr. Alan Nathan. And according to his research, every 10 degrees of temperature can add approximately 3.3 feet of distance. So if we assume that the average would be 77 degrees and we're actually going to get 100 degrees, it is possible that your average fly ball could go 7 more feet. That's not nothing. I mean, that's going to turn some warning track balls into home runs.
I mean, if you think back, for example, to those three homers that Kike Hernandez hit in Game 5, each one of them basically cleared the fence by about less than 7 feet.
Right.
So it could be the difference between a home run and not.
I mean, this could seriously have an impact. I mean, it's not just like one of those, you know, those nuggets you'll hear like an old timey broadcaster say. There's some validity to this. So that was cool. I thought that's what the physics say. That's the theoretical model, right? But we have data. We have many, many years of baseball games. So I went and first I just looked for just this year in the majors, and we can look at temperature data. So I broke it down into groups of 10 degrees, for example, 60 to 69, 70 to 79, et cetera, anything over 90, because there's just not enough data on games that are over 100, barely ever happens. And there's a pretty clear trend here. So if you were to look at games starting at 90 degrees or going higher, and obviously everything here is just at the start time. There's no pitch by pitch data, and it will cool as the night goes on. But for games this year that started at 90 degrees or warmer, 5.47 runs per game were scored. You drop that down into the 80s, it's 4.9 runs. Drop it down into the 70s, it's 4.5 runs. Very similar in the 60s. And then below 59 degrees, 4.3 runs a game. I mean, that is an undeniable trend. That's pretty clear. You do the same thing with slugging. It's 480 at the high end of the scale, 391 at the bottom end of the scale. That's the difference between Cole Calhoun and Corey Seager. I mean, that's a big deal. There, you know, you can look at home runs per plate appearance. It's just, it makes sense. And it's not just across MLB. Like, I thought that was an interesting start, but the game is played at Dodger Stadium, right? And we wanted to look at more than 1 year. So I looked at Dodger Stadium for the entirety of the 21st century. So 18 seasons of data is pretty much the same, right? When it's over 94.4 runs a game, that drops down to 4.2 in the 80s and about 4 in the 70s. Slugging percentage, you know, 416 when it's over 90, that drops down to 364 when it's below 60 at Dodger Stadium, which obviously isn't often, but it's happened. So I think this is interesting. This is one of those times where, you know, the narrative is actually backed by the data. The ball will go a little bit farther, and it's likely we will see a little bit more offense, he says, prefacing a clear 1-0 shutout through nine innings.
And how much of this do you think is, and there's no, probably no scientific answer, so I'm asking you to just, you know, hypothesize. How much do you think of this is the physics of the ball flying farther, and how much of it is pitchers fatiguing?
I think that's the right question to ask. It's a great question. I think, I mean, we know for a fact the ball will go farther. So sometimes a guy will say, oh, I gave up a ball to the warning track, I got out of the inning, but oh, tonight it's a grand slam. No doubt about that. I do think the fatigue is going to be an issue. But I also wonder if that's just going to mean that the managers are going to have a quicker hook. And that's partially because the bullpens are rested. None of these teams haven't played in a couple of days. I think if there's any game not to expect Kershaw to go eight innings, I mean, this is going to be it, right?
You know, it's sort of funny because, like, you know, I'm looking at this data you presented. And yesterday, we had one of our reporters ask Dave Roberts about the heat. And Dave Roberts was basically like, ah, well, you know, we're Southern California people. Like, we're used to the heat. It's like Southern California isn't actually that hot. In this century, the Dodgers have only played 70 home games where the start time was above 90 degrees.
Yeah, well,
that's like two per year.
He also, listen, I'm no Southern California native. I'm from New Jersey, but I know a little bit about the geography there. The weather by the beach is a lot different than the weather a little more inland where Dodger Stadium actually is. So it is a little warmer there than it is at, say, you know, the airport, which is a lot closer to the water. But you're right. And what I was kind of thinking when I was doing this is my quote unquote hot bucket was games that had a start temperature of 90 degrees and up. And this will fall into that, but it's going to be 100 degrees. I feel like that's a little bit different than 91 degrees, you know? So it's not, I don't think, unreasonable to say that this is unprecedented in recent memory. There's never been a giant air quotes fall classic in this way. And I think it's interesting. Now, Kershaw has actually only had three starts in the last 4 years where he started a game 90 degrees or hotter. It's actually been great in those three starts. He's only allowed 4 earned runs, 29 strikeouts in 23 innings. He only did it once this year at home against Kansas City, 13 strikeouts for a complete game win. However, he then took the next 9 days off because it was the All-Star game, and then he just didn't pitch the first series after that. Whether those are related, I don't know, but I found that interesting. Couldn't really do the same thing with Keuchel because it's always hot in Houston, and it's hard to know for sure if the roof was open or not that night. But I do think that a guy who gets a lot of grounders, as Keuchel does, may have somewhat of an advantage when the ball is flying because it's hard to hit a home run on the ground. So maybe that's something for him. But I think in addition to everything else we've talked about, the heat is going to be just an enormous subplot.
And it's
going to
be hot, too, for game, not quite as hot, but still be in the 90s for game two, right? And that's when Justin Verlander's pitching.
Yeah, Justin Verlander had the sixth highest fly ball rate allowed. Now, a good way to get around that is to just, you know, strike everybody out, which he's basically been doing. But it's not difficult to see him giving up one of those, you know, quote-unquote cheapish fly balls that, you know, Andre Ether seems like the perfect guy to do this, right? That just floats it over into the right field pavilion. So the heat, I think, and as you completely agree with you, the fatigue factor is going to be legit. And I wonder if that actually is going to make it more likely that you have someone like McCann being hit for by you know, a pinch hitter and then letting another catcher come in because it's so hot. I guess it's got to be brutal behind the plate.
There's no... Just thinking about that makes me tired.
I know, exactly right. All right, so Verlander, as you talked about, is going to start game two. And I know we talked a lot about Verlander last week, but then he had to go out and put up another great game, so we've got to kind of update our leaderboards. We were talking about how his spin, four-seam fastball spin, was elite, and it was especially elite in the playoffs. And then he went out last week on October 20th and had his highest spin four-seam game of the season, which also doubled as the highest spin four-seam game of the entire season for anybody and the second highest in the 3 years of StatCast tracking. He had his RPM was 2668 on October 20th, and that's his highest of the season. He has been throwing the ball both velocity and spin-wise in a way we've rarely seen him do in years.
Yeah, in game two, he had set his record, and then he beat his own personal best, and then in game six, he then went out and beat his personal best in terms of average four-seam spin rate. So he is really, you know... He's been amazing, and it will be interesting to see if he can, you know, he's been pitching indoors, climate controlled, environment in Houston, both those starts. It'll be interesting to see how that translates with the Heat, where the grip is going to be a little bit different, if like he's going to be able to get the same kind of spin on his ball.
Yeah, and it's interesting because it feels like he's been operating at like fifth gear constantly. And my friend Eno Saris of Fangraphs actually wrote about this the other day, where he was like, you know, during the season, the difference between his average fastball velocity in a game and his maximum was like 5 miles an hour. And in the postseason, it's like 1.8 miles per hour. He's basically throwing all out the entire time. And I guess, you know, it's the postseason. You want to do what you want to do. But you have to wonder if that's going to catch up with him, especially, you know, in that kind of temperature.
Yeah, they actually sort of pumped the brakes on him. He threw 99 pitches in game six, which for him is actually it's a pretty modest number. He got over 120 in game two. So he has a little bit less than usual, but he's really been throwing hard and throwing a lot of pitches. And I mean, that's sort of his, he is definitely kind of like one of those people who sort of, he's a freak. He just has sort of transcended the typical arm woes of pitchers with this kind of workload in his career. I mean, he's like kind of the closest thing we have to like a modern day Nolan Ryan or Clemens. You just sort of like, and it's obviously a different era. Not the same guys aren't throwing 300 innings in a season, but he's the closest that we have.
Yeah,
basically.
I've really enjoyed the stories that have come up about him being a little more analytical about things. Like Brad Ausmus, who just got let go by the Tigers, I don't think had very positive reviews of his tenure there, but there were some great stories about how, you know, this one game a couple years ago where Verlander got lit up, he sat him down and he's like, listen, you can't just throw your heat past these guys. You're getting a little older. You have to be a little more intelligent about it. And that got Verlander into looking at scouting reports and everything. And now you've got a guy who's got this elite skill, but he's also really smart about it. I think that's why him and the Astros are just like a perfect fit. I'm actually looking forward to what a full season of Justin Verlander in Houston will be like next year, because I think they've really helped him sort of rediscover some of the skill he had lost. And
sure.
It's been a huge payoff for them.
Yeah, no question.
And I think the last thing we want to talk about is curveballs. Curveballs have been a pretty big story, and especially so when Lance McCullers came out and threw, was it 24 straight to end the game the other night? And that was fantastic. But it's really interesting to kind of look at how these teams have both used curveballs and performed against curveballs. So, for example, when you looked at the Astros pitchers during the regular season, they threw their curveballs 14% of the time, fourth most in the majors. The Dodgers were third most. But they had by far the highest spin curves in the majors, almost 2,800 RPM. And the average is just under 2,500 RPM. So that's really high spin curves. And they had a lot of excellent production against. They had a 230 expected weighted on base against, fifth best in the majors. So the Astros, during the regular season, they throw a lot of curves. They throw a lot of high spin curves. They get good production against them. It's not, as we learned with Seth Lugo, as easy to say high spin equals success. But in this case, it worked out for them. Postseason's been interesting because it's kind of exactly the same. In the regular season, I said they had a 230 expected weighted on base. Well, postseason, 228 expected weighted on base. Call it identical. For the eight teams that, you know, advanced past the wild card, that's tied for the second best. Their curve usage is 16%. Like we said, it was 14% in the regular season. It's about the same. And, you know, the spin is basically the same. It was 2782 before, and now it's 2797. It's not that much of a difference. But it's almost entirely been because of Charlie Morton and Lance McCullers. I mean, those are the two guys who throw the most curves. And of the regular season, they were both tied for 12th of curveball spin rate amongst 230 pitchers who threw 100 curves. As we said, Charlie Morton looked fantastic. 98 in the outside corner. Oh, and here's that hammer curve. Here's Lance McCullers throwing curve, curve, curve. I mean, this is a guy who can throw 96 miles an hour. Here's 24 straight curves. You don't see that anymore. I don't know if you can actually do that sustainably, but it was a lot of fun to watch.
I mean, McCullers is sort of a test case where he's kind of trying to build his career. Was he like 60% curveballs this year or something?
He's like the right-handed Rich Hill if Rich Hill could throw 96. You know, it's really interesting. And then, you know, from the Dodgers' point of view, and I'm kind of looking at this, you know, as hitters, right, against these Houston pitchers. During the regular season, they had a 297 expected weighted on base against curves. That was the best in baseball. They only saw 10% curves. That was the second fewest in baseball. There's scouting reports for you. They're doing very good. Don't throw them. The postseason's interesting, though. 208 expected weighted on base against curves. That's actually the weakest of the eight non-wildcard teams. And they're seeing 17% curves. I don't think they've suddenly changed their skill level in the last couple weeks, but I do find that interesting that they're starting to see more curves and performing a little weaker against them. I don't think that's a trend, but it's a thing that has happened, and I think that's interesting.
Yeah, well, I mean, the game one and two starters, Keuchel and Verlander, aren't big curveball guys. I mean, Verlander throws one, but it's one of, like, you know, one of two different breaking pitches he throws. Earlier in his career, he was much more of a straight curveball guy. Now it's just sort of part of his repertoire. It will be fascinating once we get to three and four. Presumably, I don't know how they're going to line up the rotation. They may try and piggyback McCullers and Morton again. They may try and have one start three and start four with maybe McHugh as a piggyback for one and Peacock for the other. That's one of those, you know, where maybe Hinch will play his hand today, or he'll probably wait, you know, maybe to see how games one and two go before he decides. But that's going to be another interesting sublot.
Yeah, I remember we first started talking about spin rate a couple years ago, and Colin McHugh was always the first guy we talked about. That he was the first case we knew of where a team had signed a guy because they liked his curveball spin, and he wasn't, you know, that productive with the Mets or with the Rockies, and then he went to the Astros, and he's been a perfectly usable mid-rotation starter for the last couple of years. And we know that the Dodgers, you know, love Rich Hill's spin, and we've heard guys on the record saying they signed me because of my spin rate. So I don't think that there's anything to this in the sense that the Dodgers suddenly can't hit curveballs. I do think that not having Corey Seager probably hasn't helped them there, but it's interesting because I don't think you're going to see the Astros go into the World Series and suddenly stop throwing curveballs, right? Like, that's what they do. It's what they're going to continue to do.
For sure.
So that's our show. And I think, you know, as we've only kind of scraped the surface of, there's so many interesting subplots to this story. I'm what's your prediction?
I don't love the way the Astros are set up right now, with the lefties starting the first two games. And I think the Dodgers bullpen is deeper. So I think, and they have home field. I'll take the Dodgers in six.
See, it's taking any team in six is like the cop-out answer, but it's exactly what I was going to say. So Dodgers in six as well. Like, I feel like you can't be so arrogant as to say, oh, it's going to be over in four or five, but who wants to predict in seven? So Dodgers in six, Dodgers in six. The next time we speak, I guess we'll catch up on where we are. Thanks for listening to our show. This is the MLB.com StatCast podcast.